Okay, and now is the time in our service when we are going to have our offering. And this morning, our offertory music is going to be Jim and Carol, and it's going to be Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And the tie-in for me is that Emily Dickinson was quite preoccupied with eternity, and somehow this fits in. So as you make your offerings, and I guess I have the baskets here, we will hear this music.
Not like lemon drops, so way above the chimney tops, that's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why then, oh, why can't I? If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why, oh, why can't I?
We don't have the children with us today, so obviously we're not going to have a children's message. So the next thing that we're going to do in our service is to have a responsive reading before I begin the talk on Emily Dickinson. The reading is number 536, and it is by Mary Oliver, a poet, a current poet who's very much loved, who is has many affinities to Emily Dickinson, particularly in their great love for and finding of the spiritual in nature. So this is to sort of lead us into the talk about Emily Dickinson, the morning poem by Mary Oliver, and a responsive reading. So I'll read the first section, and then you read the italicized. Every morning the world is created. And fasten themselves to the high branches, and the ponds appear like black cloth on which are painted islands of summer lilies.
If it is your nature to be happy, you will swim away along the soft trails for hours, your imagination lighting everywhere.
And if your spirit carries within it the thorn that is heavier than lead, if it's all you can do to keep on trudging, each pond with its blazing lilies is a prayer heard and answered lavishly every morning.
Whether or not you have ever cared to be happy, whether or not you have ever cared to pray.
Well, I'm so happy that you are here this morning to participate in this, my great love for Emily Dickinson. And I have to begin by saying that the reason that I wanted to give this talk is twofold. Number one, my husband, who is a rare book collector, bought and gave me a copy of the very first edition of the poems of Emily Dickinson, edited by Colonel Higginson and Mary Loomis Todd, the mistress of Austin Dickinson. More about that later. Anyway, he gave me that copy, three volumes. Very, very historical and very incredible. And then the other thing was my reading, and actually my husband gave me this as well, my reading of Helen Vindler's book, Dickinson, which is a commentary on 150 of Emily Dickinson's poems, read and analyzed in such a way that it was almost like a fire was lit in my brain when I started reading it, and I thought, there's something here that I would like to present to the fellowship. So those were the two impelling aspects of wanting to give this talk today. I'm wondering now how many of you have the image of Emily Dickinson as a shy, retiring spinster, recluse, flitting around her house in a white dress? Some people do. All right. I'm here this morning to dispel, I hope, that myth and to put in its place an Emily Dickinson who was a powerful woman for her time, a powerful writer, and who created through her mind and her imagination an understanding for all of us who come to her poetry that the brain is wider than the sky. So I'd like to organize this into four different sections. I'd like to talk about the mind of the poet as a power, and then I'd like to look into the background that she came from, the Puritan Calvinist background. Then I'd like to go to her relation to society, to the society of her time, and then finally to finish with what I believe is her unique vision and this imaginative approach that she took. Dickinson, I think, was not only one of the greatest poets of the 19th century, but she is really one of the greatest poets of all time. And I'm going to quote the critic Harold Bloom, who is controversial in some ways, but there's no doubt that he's really a genius when it comes to the canon of literature. And he wrote, "In conceptual scope, originality, and profundity, Dickinson surpasses any other literary mind since Shakespeare's." Wow, what a statement. "This makes her both elliptical and richly difficult. You can read and teach her for a lifetime and still find yourself always commencing anew." He also adds that, and this is another aspect of Dickinson, because many people see her as this Calvinist, concerned with God kind of person and following her tradition. He also adds that from childhood on, Dickinson was a nonconformist in religion. In our contemporary America, that is right now in the year 2012, there is no one who would consider Dickinson to be Christian. Dickinson's Jesus was not her Redeemer. She did not believe in a general resurrection. Jesus was, for her, the exemplary sufferer, allied to her hope for triumphing over her own anguishes and the losses of those she loved. The background of Emily Dickinson is, I'd like to touch on the background of Emily Dickinson because I think it plays into some of her expectations and also what she really was. She was born in 1830. In a Puritan New England family. She attended church as a child. She knew the hymns of the day, which certainly influenced the cadence and the rhythms of her poems. And she also knew the Bible very thoroughly. She could quote it, refer to it, popped up over and over again, references in her letters. She attended Mount Holyoke, which at that time was a female seminary, religious female seminary. She did this in the 1840s. And it was a time when the spiritual revival was really running rampant in the country. People were getting saved all over the place in New England and accepting Jesus as their savior. And she just refused ever to do that because she didn't feel it. She didn't believe it. All the girls in the school were being pressured, really pressured, to accept, get their salvation and accept Jesus. And she just wouldn't. She was a holdout. There were other girls who were as well, but they were in the minority. In one letter, she talked about this, the story of Jesus and Jesus coming to save us for our sins. She thought it was similar to the story of Santa Claus. It was a really nice story, but not very believable. So in a time when women were expected to be subservient, to marry, to raise Christian children, good Christian family, she was brave enough to be true to herself. Now, this came in the context of a family that was a pretty liberal family, except that her mother was very, very religious, was saved, and was concerned that the other members of the family were not. She had a sister, Lavinia, younger, a brother, Austin, older, and then her father, who was a lawyer in the town. And they had not accepted their salvation. But one by one, they did. And the mother, of course, was very happy about that, but it wasn't... Emily wasn't so happy about it. But one by one, each member of the family became saved. First was her father, then it was Lavinia, her sister, and then the last holdout. Austin was not going to do it at all, but finally, and I think it was probably because he was courting the woman that he married, Sue, at the time, he finally said he was saved. And so she just wouldn't bow under the pressure. At one point, she stopped going to church, and actually, there was some suggestion that she was too frail and maybe it was too difficult on her, but my thought is that probably her father knew that she just didn't want to be there. Anyhow, her father allowed her not to go, and so she had her own service at home for herself, looking out the window at the flowers. In a Victorian world, this is the thing that amazes me about Emily Dickinson, that in a Victorian world where if you see these pictures of the women in these corsets and these big fluffy black dresses and all this stuff that they were wearing, all women went corseted. They dressed up in all this stuff, and she didn't. She wore this simple white work dress. She did not wear a corset. And she wanted this freedom. She wanted to be free to not to be into all this claptrap that they were in. I saw a recreation of that dress, not the actual dress, but people knew what it looked like from descriptions. And they made a copy of that dress, and they have it in a little, at her home in Amherst, which is a museum. They had it in a sort of plastic cubicle you could see the dress, and made exactly to her specifications so you could see how big she was. She was probably about this tall, and here was her dress. And in the dress are these pockets, very utilitarian pockets, that she kept pieces of paper and little pencils so that when she went about her daily task, if she was doing household work or that kind of thing, she could take out a piece of paper and write down her thought before she would forget it. So 280 Main Street, that's the address for Emily Dickinson's house in Amherst. And it's interesting that the poet Adrienne Rich, who is a feminist poet, began writing in the 70s, has written a very, I didn't bring it along with me, but I do recommend it to you. It's called Vesuvius at Home. So just the title Vesuvius will give you a little idea of the explosive nature of the of her book, of her essay. It's called The Power of Emily Dickinson, Vesuvius at Home. She also visited the home in Amherst. And one of the things that she said was that probably no poet ever lived so much and so purposefully in one house, even in one room. Her niece Martha, Emily Dickinson's niece Martha, daughter of Sue and Austin, who lived next door, had a home next door, told of visiting her in her corner bedroom on the second floor, and how Emily Dickinson made as if to lock the door with an imaginary key and turned and said, "Maddie, here's freedom." I stood in that room and I thought about Dickinson saying that and holding up that key, and for me it became a symbol of her power. She could choose that. She made that choice to do it, and for her it was freedom from all the stuff that she might have had to do. So further along in the essay, Rich finds it strange that when an Emily Dickinson stamp was created in 1971, the poem selected for it was a kind of Girl Scout prayer, which happens to be in our hymnal, number 292. And I asked Claire not to choose it this morning. It's one of our songs. Rich was couldn't understand why they would pick, of all the poems that she had, why they would pick this kind of Girl Scout prayer. If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain. If I can ease one life the aching, or cool one pain, or help one fainting robin into his nest again, I shall not live in vain. So Rich asked the question, how can this Girl Scout prayer kind of thing align with the powerful poems that Emily Dickinson actually wrote? Now, I made copies of all the poems I'm going to discuss today, and I'd like for you just to pass them out and share them so you can read along with me as I'm reading them. So these are the poems that I've elected to use this morning, to talk about this morning, and you will see that they are numbered. And that is because when her work was edited after her death, the editors took great liberties. They created titles. They created punctuation. She did not title her poems. She just wrote the poem. So the numbers are numbers that have come from the scholar who has put together all the poems, and he's numbering them in chronological order, and that's where the number comes from. So number 477, "He Fumbles at Your Soul." So think about this poem in relationship to the Girl Scout prayer. "He fumbles at your soul as players at the keys before they drop full music on. He stuns you by degrees, prepares your brittle nature for the ethereal blow by fainter hammers, further heard, then nearer, then so slow. Your breath has time to straighten, your brain to bubble cool, deals one imperial thunderbolt that scalps your naked soul. When winds hold forest in their paws, the universe is still." So, the real question, Rich says, is given that the art of poetry is an art of transformation, how this woman's mind and imagination may have used the masculine element in the world at large, or those elements personified as masculine, including the men she knew, how her relationship to this reveals itself in her images and language. In a patriarchal culture flamed with religious revivals, and where the sermon was still an active, if perishing, literary form, the equation of divinity with maleness was so fundamental that it is hardly surprising to find Dickinson, like many an early mystic, blurring erotic with religious experience and imagery. The poem has intimations both of seduction and rape merged with the intense force of a religious experience. Rich concludes that the poem is about a poet's relationship to her own power, which is exteriorized in masculine form, much as masculine poets have invoked the female muse. In writing at all, particularly in orthodox and original poetry like Dickinson's, women have often felt in danger of losing their status as women. And this status has always been defined in terms of their relationship to men: daughter, sister, bride, wife, mother, muse. To acknowledge that power and commit oneself to it, as Emily Dickinson did, was an immense decision. Well, Rich goes on to berate the male critics who have tried to edit and standardize Dickinson's punctuation and typography, and especially John Crow Ransom, who taught at Kenyon College. You probably know that, Jim. And here's what he had to say about Emily. He called her a little homekeeping person, who, while she had a proper notion of the final destiny of her poems, was not one of those poets who had advanced to that later stage of operations where manuscripts are prepared for the printer and the poet's diction has to make concessions to the publisher's style book. Ransom, Rich says, goes on to print several of her poems altered by him with all possible forbearance. What might in a male writer, a Thoreau or a William Blake, seem a legitimate strangeness, a unique intention, has been in one of our major poets devalued into a kind of a naivete, girlish ignorance, a feminine lack of professionalism, just as the poet herself has been made into a sentimental object. And here's another quote. "Most of us are half in love with this dead girl," confesses Archibald MacLeish. Well, Emily Dickinson was 55 years old when she died. She wasn't really a girl. So, on now to the poet as a member of society. Although she was nonconformist, Dickinson had really warm family relationships with her brother, her sister, her parents. Her father was a well-known, respected lawyer in Amherst. She attended school, as I mentioned. She went to the Amherst Academy, and then she was at the Mount Holyoke Female Seminary. So she had some education, which I believe she had to leave because of her she was somewhat frail. But she read prodigiously. She wrote letters to friends. She was writing a letter almost every day of her life and keeping in touch with the world. From her letters, which fortunately is part of what Mabel Loomis Todd did when she started editing these poems, she went around to everybody and got their letters, because Emily Dickinson often would write a poem in a letter. Anyhow, she just wanted to get all these letters. So that's a big thanks to her, because had she not done that, who knows if people would have thrown them away. So she went around, got the letters, and from those letters, we know that she was keeping in touch with the world, and we know that that she probably began writing poetry for real in around 1850, when she was 20 years old. She began stitching the poems together in something that's called a fascicle, and you can just see her with her needle and thread sewing these fascicles together, which she didn't show to anybody. She did it for herself. She kept it in her drawer and then in a box under the bed. And during the course of time, over several years from 1850 on, she created about 40 of these fascicles, what are called fascicles. And altogether, by 1864, she had completed 40 of them, which was about 800 poems. And those are all the things that Franklin took apart, because some of them had been redone by the editors and re-put together. And he looked at all the little pinholes and decided which poems went where and tried to put them back together in the order that they were in. After that, from 1871 to 1875, most of her poems she wrote in scraps of paper. And she had that paper in her pocket. So she'd write it on a scrap of paper, and that would be how you'd have the poem. She did travel in her early years. She went to places like Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Boston. But we know that around 1860, there came a time when she really decided that she wasn't going to leave her home anymore. And we really know that from the basis of her letters, that this was a choice that she was making. It wasn't something that she was fearful. I heard when I was giving this talk at another place, and someone in the group said to me, when she was in college, she heard that Emily Dickinson had been raped in the woods, and that's why she never went out of the house again. That's really not actual and didn't really happen. She really made the choice to begin isolating herself, and there was pretty good reason for her to do it, as mentioned before. This is an article that appeared in the New York Times back in May of 2010, and the author of this article says that he thought that this bedroom was an empowerment zone. That she retreated to. She knew the work she wanted to do. There were serious odds against her doing it, social and personal. At some point, she realized emphatically that she had to create a place of absolute concentration where no distractions stood between her and her work, where no talk interfered with the new language she was inventing, where she could ignore the knock on the door, refuse the callers. And when she was asked, actually it was Colonel Higginson, her, quote, master, the editor, who said, didn't she miss getting out, seeing people and all of that? And this sort of shows her sense of humor, too, which is a whole other subject, her sense of her wit and her sense of humor. She answered, I never thought of conceiving that I could ever have the slightest approach to such a want in all future time. And then she added, I feel that I have not expressed myself strongly enough. So she had a great wit, and she did express it to Colonel Higginson. One thing that she did write to, she wrote to Higginson in 1862, and she did it probably for a lot of reasons, but she asked him, was her poem alive? Was her poetry alive? She sent him a few poems. He was an editor in Boston. Were her poems alive? Were they really breathing? What did he think? And he knew that there was a real seed of something in her. He knew that she was an important writer and an important person. But he was very much a person of the fashions of the time, and advised her that he didn't think the world was ready for her poems in the format and in the way she wanted to write them, with all those dashes and no titles and her strange spellings and all the other things. So he advised her not to publish. However, he did reinforce for her that that her poems did have some merit. And he later on, after her death, did write an article for the Saturday Review in which he talked about these things. And again, about the fact that although she didn't fit the proper grammar, proper spelling, and all of those things, that she did have some merit as a poet. Although she asked for Higginson's advice and she named herself his scholar and she called him her master, she really never altered. She never changed any of her poems to reflect the changes that he suggested that she make. He just never did it. She never did it. So that sort of means that she was calling him master, but she didn't really think he was the master. Otherwise, she might have changed something. And when, as I mentioned before, when he and Mabel Todd, Loomis Todd edited, they changed things. And then, of course, this scholar, very important book. This is the man who went back and painstakingly put everything back, Franklin. Did that, they sort of undid all those things. And we got the punctuation back and the poetry back as she actually intended it to be. So what is this unique vision that Emily Dickinson had. Emily Dickinson is mystic. It is, the imagination is greater than God. So that is very astonishing that anybody at that time might have thought the imagination is greater than God. The power of the brain, the human brain, is greater than God. New England was the center, we've spoken before here, of the Transcendental Movement in the 1840s and 50s. And her friends did give her a copy of Emerson's poems, and she read them and she loved them. And actually, they probably influenced her some in her poetry as she began to write poetry. But her attitude toward paint, she really established her own viewpoint. It wasn't the viewpoint of the Transcendentalist. Her attitude toward pain and suffering and toward the facts of existence was much more realistic than Emerson's vision. And although he inspired these her earlier poems and her beginning of writing of poetry, it's very interesting that her sister-in-law and brother had this beautiful home next door to them in Amherst, and they had all kinds of famous writers and artists and politicians and people coming to visit. And sometimes Emily would go over when someone was there that she wanted to meet. But it's interesting that when Emerson visited in 1857, she didn't go over. So it just suggests that maybe he wasn't as influential in her life as he had been for a lot of other writers. Probably her spiritual preoccupations are more related to Coleridge and Blake, the Romantic poets. Blake attached great importance to the human imagination as an aspect of some mystery beyond the human. And the world of imagination, Blake said, the world of imagination is the world of eternity. So at the most intense, her vision matched and transcended Blake's. So she was born into a family where, and a society, where the majority of the people were saved. But she never attained that salvation. She made herself a god. And that's my thesis today. She made herself a god through the power of her imagination and her brain. And in Emily Dickinson, as Helen Vendler indicates in her powerful analysis of those 150 poems, the individual brain could weigh itself against God and be the winner. That was just incredible in those days. So you can see why Higginson didn't think her poetry, the world was ready for her poetry, that someone would make that kind of statement. In the weight of God against language, language triumphs. Only human beings can create syllables. This is the highest claim that Emily Dickinson made for the mind. So poem number 598, the brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for heft them pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound. She just, in this poem, so brilliantly outstripped her American poetic contemporaries, with the exception of Walt Whitman, in writing both about nature and about death, and for this defiant critique of Christianity that she had, and her uninhibited scrutiny of its concepts, it's just unequaled in other poets of her day. Her most acute remark on God is made in this poem in the wake of contemplating the powers of the human brain. What is the relation of the brain to the divine? The brain and God weigh the same, she says. We can see this when we lift them, using our two hands as a part of a scale, they are equal. And the difference we feel is language. God, through nature, utters sounds, but human language alone is stated in syllables. The poet exists to reframe in intelligible syllables the unintelligible sounds of God. This boast presumes a divinity who is exceeded in power by humanity. What is worthy of reverence? Her poem is a repudiation of the conventional superiority of the divine creator to the human creature. The poem, Much Madness and Divinest Sense, shows Dickinson's unconventional thought, and it also attributes divinity to the human being. Dickinson wants freedom from that chain in the poem. And again, the image of her holding up the key resonates. She's locked her own door, and she will not be chained. Number 620, much madness is divinest sense. To a discerning eye, much sense the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority, in this as all, prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demure, you're straightway dangerous and handled with a chain. So this sympathy with the people who are mad, it's not unexpected for this time. Brader said already addressed this. But the sharp comment, assent and you are sane, doesn't prepare us for the transformation that we get to her discerning this undiscerning majority, which has become a sadistic mob that's going to impose chains on anybody who disagrees with them. And what has the offender done to deserve this? Demure. I mean, there's such a soft, gentle word, demure, and that's going to get you in chains. It's polite. But the slightest degree of unconformity is punished. Everyone knew instantly by this kind of language that she refused conventionality. One of my favorite poems, and I think I've read it here before, is The Soul Selects Its Own Society. And I think the reason that I like this poem so much, and it's the first time in poetry when I really understood that the sound of a poem emphasizes and forwards the meaning of the poem. So number 409, the soul selects her own society, then shuts the door to her divine majority, present no more. Unmoved, she notes the chariots pausing at her low gate. Unmoved, an emperor be kneeling upon her mat. I've known her from an ample nation. Choose one, then close the valves of her attention like stone. This really represents Dickinson's great courage in deciding the kind of life she's going to live. She isn't going to be bothered by anybody that comes knocking at her door. Mabel Lubens Todd, her editor, I mean, sucked up to her sister-in-law all the time, and also her sister Lavinia, and tried to get over there, came over for tea, wanted to see her, but she never, ever appeared to Mabel Lubens Todd, who actually then became her editor. She never once appeared. She might have come down once and listened in the hallway when Mabel was playing something on the piano, but she never once. Mabel even did all this writing about her later and all these collections of her poems, never once saw her or spoke to her, which is kind of interesting. Emily Dickinson knew the friends she wanted to have. She knew the people that she wanted to see, and she did see people. People came to the house, and she orchestrated that and chose her situation and knew when she wanted to do it and who she wanted to see. So finally, I believe that Dickinson understood that most people in society would not be able to understand her poems or her vision. She deferred to Higginson, as I said. She called him master. But she really didn't change her poems to reflect what he suggested. She kept them the way she had it. She kept her own truth. The last poem that I want to discuss today is To Tell the Truth, But Tell It Slant. I gave this title, I've liked robbing lines from Emily Dickinson over the years and for my artwork. And so I took this title for one of my paintings, and Jim came to the show, and he asked me later, what did I mean by telling the truth slant? So I titled this painting, Tell All the Truth, But Tell It Slant. And he said, what does that mean? So tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight. The truth's superb surprise, as lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. So She's mediating the truth out of kindness. She doesn't want people to be suddenly struck with horror over the truth, and they can't really accept it anyway. It has to be gradual. So the vision she has, the truth she sees, she wants it to be told gradually, understanding human nature, and that that's the way it has to happen, because people can't really accept it, truth, bang, all of a sudden, like the thunderbolt. So Emily Dickinson subverted orthodox belief. She posited her own belief in the imagination and the power of the poet's words to create a universe. It's been an incredible adventure for me to put together this program. I've fallen in love with Emily Dickinson all over again. And I found that there are even more dimensions in her work than I ever imagined. That's the way Shakespeare has been for me. You go back again and again and again and again, and every time you go, you find something else, some insight, something that tells you something about our human experience, the mysteries that we have in our world, and how we are using and going to the great thinkers and writers to explain those mysteries to us. I have no doubt I'm going to return to these poems over and over again to experience the power of imagination in delving into the deepest mysteries of human life.